I'm David Lazarus, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of April 10th, 2015. Beginnings. They're a time of hope.
Only new good things start in the beginning.
When it comes to your money, they can mean new and exciting chapters in your life.
A new job, maybe a promotion, maybe a new purchase, a new asset.
Marriage is a beginning. Kids going to school is a beginning. Retirement is a beginning. That's what I'm looking forward to.
Or maybe chapters that aren't so exciting.
For my generation, I think about college loans. It's affecting a lot of people my age. I think about finding a job after graduation.
This is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. I'm David Lazarus from the LA Times, in for Lizzie O'Leary. Lizzie's taking some time off. She'll be back real soon. Until then, I'm keeping the captain's chair warm. This week, we're talking about fresh starts, the ones we deal with economically, in our homes, in our relationships, even our bodies. Are you making a new beginning in your financial life? Let us know by visiting marketplaceweekend.org and clicking on Go. Or you can tweet us. We're at MarketplaceWKND. So let's dive into our own new beginning here. Every day, our By the Numbers blog on marketplace.org gives you the numbers worth watching. Here are Marketplace digital producers Tobin Lowe and Tony Wagner to serve up some of the week's biggest numbers.
Thanks, David. Okay, Tony, our first number this week is $675,000.
Right, that's how much travelers left behind at airport security checkpoints last year, according to CNBC. And that change jar has been growing for the past few years. Any money left behind goes right into the TSA's budget, so some airports have placed donation boxes for local charities in front of security. That way, flyers can donate their spare change somewhere else. Okay, next number, $47,000.
That's the median pay bump MBAs enjoyed after earning their degree, according to a Bloomberg survey. Plus, people who switched fields after getting their MBA saw an even bigger raise. And how about this for a segue? Speaking of grad school, let's talk about children. Our next number is $20.
That's how much it costs to get into a hot party at a New York nightclub for children. A company called SirKiz has built a business on organizing parties for children and parents during the day when clubs would usually be closed. They routinely sell out, and now SirKiz is looking to expand outside of Manhattan. Okay, last number, 1%.
The U.S. dollar rose in strength by more than 1% on Tuesday. Sounds good, right? Sort of. Some point out that a strong dollar could create difficulty in the global market as other currencies falter.
Thanks, guys. And for more of the day's and the week's most important stats, visit the By the Numbers blog at marketplace.org. Spring is in the air, along with the promise of new beginnings. And aside from the beginning of allergy season and those clouds of pollen, that can mean April in Paris. In fact, there hasn't been a better time for Americans to cross the Atlantic since the euro was created back in 1995. It's not just Europe. The dollar is up against almost every other currency worldwide. So is this the beginning of a new age of U.S. dollar dominance? Marketplace's explainer-in-chief, Patty Hirsch, is here with some answers. Bonjour, monsieur.
Hello, David.
Since we're talking about beginnings, is this the beginning of a new era of total global domination for the dollar?
Not total, but for a little while, we might see some dollar domination. There's no doubt that as the U.S. economy does better than everybody else's, which it pretty much is right now. I mean, you know, China's slowing down, Russia's got problems, the euro, well, it's a complete mess. So in comparison to all those other economies, the U.S. is doing really well. And as a result of that, the dollar does really well. So yes, you are going to see a strong dollar for a while, but it's not going to be forever.
But that means that basically, as long as the dollar is the go-to currency, the safe harbor, people are going to be amassing it. That keeps it strong. And you're in a very virtuous cycle dollar-wise.
That's absolutely right. And the fact is that, you know, everybody wants the dollar because it's so easy to use. It's really, really liquid. It means it's easy to buy and sell. Everybody uses it all over the world. Because there's so much utility to the dollar, that means that people are prepared to pay more for it because it is so useful to use.
Now, let's pretend for a moment that I'm not an expert in currency markets.
Okay.
Just pretending. What is it that makes one currency stronger than another?
It's the utility and the demand that comes from that utility. If you're in Indonesia, for example, and you're buying from Malaysia and China, right, and you're selling into Egypt and Brazil, you've got five currencies going on there, right? It's really, really difficult to do all of your business in five currencies. It's much more easy to do it in one currency. So there's the utility of the dollar. It's just one currency. It's easy to get hold of dollars at any point in time. So everybody wants to do business in those dollars. Secondly, the dollar is the currency that's used to trade all commodities, everything from corn to oil to gold. Everybody uses the dollar. And thirdly, it is the world's reserve currency, right? Every country keeps a chunk of money in reserve for a rainy day. And that money is usually US dollar dominated. Now, you're probably asking yourself, why would it be US dollars? Why not just use your own currency? Well, the answer is because everybody accepts it. Say, for example, you are the leader of a beleaguered West African country and things go really, really bad in your economy and you need to buy stuff from your trade partners. Well, people might not want your currency, your, you know, West African francs or whatever you've got hoarded, but they will take US dollars. So that's why people want to have that US dollar as the reserve currency.
That sounds also like a bit of a red flag, because if the Chinese or the Russians are hoarding dollars for exactly the reasons you're talking about, what if they start selling them off?
Yes, you can have a situation where, you know, they would, if they pumped all of those dollars into the economy, because you'd have so much supply in relation to demand, you could see the dollar drop. And that might be a problem for people who wanted to have a really strong dollar. But the fact is that the Chinese and the Russians do have lots of dollars. They'd much rather that the price of those dollars doesn't go down too precipitously, because then that leaves them out of the money.
Now, let's pull this out of policy wonk and bring it back into real life. And that is, if I'm contemplating a trip overseas, maybe this spring, maybe this summer, good time to use all those strong dollars?
Absolutely. Paris is on sale basically right now. You know, you go to Paris, I mean, your dollar is 30 or 40% more purchasing power than it did this time last year. That's great. So yes, use those dollars to your advantage if you're an individual consumer. You know, the thing about a strong dollar is that it's tough for exporters, because if you make stuff in the US, it means your stuff is more expensive, right? Which means that, you know, you're going to do less business. But if you're an importer, if you're buying stuff from overseas and you have a strong dollar, it means you're buying all day long. It's great because the stuff is really, really cheap. So essentially, as a tourist, you are in effect an importer of goods from the European Union or wherever it is that you're going.
So this is the time to buy that Chanel scarf or new BMW.
This is the time to import those goods. Absolutely.
So clearly all of the external cues speak to the idea of a very strong dollar. What will it take to weaken the dollar?
Well, it's going to take other economies in the world doing better. And the fact is they're not doing that well right now, but things will get better for the Europeans. Things will get better for the Russians. You know, the world will turn and the dollar will turn on its cycle. So yes, it's strong right now, but it's not going to remain strong forever. As those economies recover, you'll see demand for the dollar drop. And as a result of that, you'll see the price of the dollar fall as well.
So the trend line for the dollar might be on a southward trajectory once you accept that the rest of the global economies have turned a corner and are on the mend.
Exactly. We are basically the best looking horse in the glue factory right now, you know, and as a result, our dollar does better than anybody else's. But that's not going to last.
Still a glue factory.
Sticky business.
Patty Hirsch, as always, you know what you're talking about. Thank you so much.
Thank you, David.
Now we have the story of a rough beginning. Javier Chavez was only 8 when he began getting into trouble. He was involved with the Los Angeles gang by the time he was 11. He's been arrested multiple times on charges ranging from selling drugs to possessing a weapon. His longest stint in prison was 4 years. Javier's 33 now, and after some hard knocks, he says he's getting a second chance at life.
They used to call me Spooky. They used to call me Spooky for the simple fact that I like to spook people. If I could like catch you walking, what we call it out there, slipping, and meaning that you got your guard down, and I could run up on you or walk up to you and really like pressure you, sometimes people get spooked because you don't know who was coming around the corner, you know? And so I used to like doing that, just catching people walking with their guard down and just, you know? I could say it was kind of like two different worlds, man. I'm living one way, society's living a different way. What looked good to you was not good to me. And what was good to me was not good to society. And it wasn't like I was born and said I'm going to be a gangster when I grew up. Now, I had dreams as a kid, too. Like, I wanted to be a firefighter or a cop or, you know, I used to have these dreams as a kid, you know? But somewhere along the line, there was, like, these mishappenings at home or whatever happened out there or just feelings in general, as you know. And, I lost a lot of years, man, off and on. It wasn't, like, a long stretch period, but it was, like, periods of times, 5 years here, 4 years here, 3 years here, violation here of a year, a few months in the county here and there, you know? And aside from that, my life of addiction, 23 years in drug addiction, it took a little toll on me, right? And, it made me do things sometimes that I never thought I would have done. You know, at one point I walked around with so much pride in my neighborhood, and then there's that second part of me that when drug addiction took over, I just lost control of my life. It's been 3 years since the last time I was incarcerated. And I got caught with 38 balloons of heroin, and I was facing some time, and I was just kind of like, looking at it like, here we go again, kind of like the merry-go-round. You jump on one horse, and it's still only going round. So it was just, I'll jump from one horse to the next one, and everything was still going round. I was just going in circles. And I remember being in the county, in the L.A. County Jail, and I looked around, and I asked myself, is this it? Everything I've done my whole life, from doing crimes, getting high, robbing, stealing, is this it? Is this the grand price? You know, being in a cell block with another man, spending the rest of my life right there, or just sitting down in a cage. And it was a turnaround point, man. You know, but I think I just want to have, like, people understand that we're all human. We all go through things. I call this a second chance at life, man. I got my own place. I pay rent. I used to think I was dumb because I dropped out, right? But when I got that GED, like, it pumped me up to look at myself and be like, you know what? Man, I could do big things, man, in life, you know? Once I got to that point where I changed, or I started changing things about the way I see life, great things started happening for me, you know?
That was Javier Chavez. These days, he's a supervisor and mentor at Homeboy Industries. That's a Los Angeles program for at-risk youth. He's also in his second year at East LA College. In this week's show, we're talking about the new beginnings in our economic lives. It's spring. The weather's getting warmer. Flowers are blooming. And it's time for a fresh start for your home. This is remodeling season. Spending on everything from new kitchens to total domestic makeovers is on the upswing, as evidenced by a recent surge in mortgage refinancing. A fresh coat of paint, a new bathroom, they can be costly, but it can also be a smart investment, whether you're staying put or looking to sell. For some tips about how to handle home renovations, let's turn to a pro. Tom Silva, general contractor for This Old House on PBS. Hiya, Tom.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. So let's talk a little bit about the do's and don'ts of a home remodel. If indeed you're ready to take the plunge, should you go all in and do every project conceivable, or should you go bit by bit?
Well, I guess it really depends on budget, number one, what kind of money you're planning on spending. But I think realistically what people should think about first is their house and the value of their house in relationship to their neighborhood. How much money should they put in their house and expect to get it back? Basically, what I'm trying to say is you don't want to overbuild the house for the neighborhood because it'll take you a long time to get that money back. So you got to be careful that way. You also have to know about the house itself, the bones of the house, the structure. How good is it? Is it capable of withstanding a good renovation project? So I guess what you have to do is really think about your house and the neighborhood and how much money you're planning on putting into that house, because you don't want to be the, let's say, the most expensive guy on the block, because it's going to take you longer to get your investment back.
Does that mean that it'd be smart to look at some of the comps that are out there, maybe go to Zillow.com, look at the various housing prices, and try and get a sense of the trend in your neighborhood?
Absolutely. Zillow is a great, quick way to get references on surrounding areas, values, and to see if you're in that mid-range value or even the low guy on the block gives you a lot more flexibility.
When it comes to budgeting, is there any sense of how much you should devote to a remodel relative to the overall cost of your house? So let's say you have a $500,000 house. Is there some sort of limit that how much you should put into remodel as opposed to, say, selling the house and trading up or moving sideways?
Well, again, it that depends on your neighborhood and your investment. I mean, you got to think about what kind of remodel are you thinking about doing, whether it's a kitchen remodel or a bathroom remodel. You know, you want to look at basically the value of the house and how much money you're going to put into that house. So your kitchen, for example, the investment of that kitchen may pay you back, 60 or 70% of the value that you've invested in it. You got to be careful of that. A bathroom remodel may pay you back a little bit more.
When it comes to enhancing your home's resale value, is there any particular part of a remodel you should focus on? For example, the kitchen, the bathroom, the air conditioning, the central heating?
Well, I guess you can focus on all of those things if any of them are in trouble. But I think the biggest thing that is going to make your home sell is a nice bathroom and a nice kitchen. And I think that that's an investment that will pay you back.
And should I be in an experimenting mood when I do that, or should I go plain vanilla?
Well, again, you got to think about how long you're going to stay in that house. Are you just fixing this house up to stay there for a couple of years and sell it? You got to think about, are you a serious cook, for example, if you're in the kitchen? What kind of fixes you would want? Or is it just a kitchen that everybody gathers and has fun in? Or do you like to entertain? All of those things have to come into play if you're renovating a kitchen. If you're trying to sell your house and you want to do a renovation, you got to think about how it's going to look to others. You want to be careful of what you choose. You don't want to have something weird in there. You want to have something that's trendy, that when someone comes to look at that house, they really like it.
How hands-on should you be? Should you allow your contractor, your architect, your designer, your feng shui consultant to take the lead in a lot of these decisions? Or should you be there every step of the way saying, I found this countertop, I found this refrigerator, I found this faucet, and be very, very micro in terms of what's going to be going into the remodel?
Well, I think that's a matter of personal preference. I think that a homeowner should definitely spend some time doing their homework on fixtures, appliances, how they want the room to look, what kind of flooring do they like. They should have a list of options, and they should have photographs and pictures. Pull them out of magazines. You know, I like this floor, I like this, and so on down the line. And then I would say talk to an architect to figure out if you can do it, or even a kitchen or an interior design person would give you a lot of options and tell you whether or not some of your ideas are good and whether or not they can even happen economically.
There's kind of a rule of thumb that if your contractor says it'll take 5 months or 6 months to get the project done, it'll take 7 months or 8 months, and oftentimes your planned budget will go up by about a third. Does that seem accurate to you?
Well, I don't know if it could go that long. It can happen because if you don't have your items picked out early, things that are on order may take 3 to 4 weeks, sometimes 6 weeks or 10 weeks, depending on where it's coming from, to get deliveries. I always tell a homeowner, if you're picking out a tile, for example, pick out that tile and have a backup that you like, that maybe that first choice will fall through, but you have another one already on the shelf that you may say, okay, well, I'm going to switch to this one, and I know I can get it in 10 days or a week or whatever. But a backup is always good to have.
That's great advice. Tom Silva is general contractor for This Old House on PBS. Tom, thank you very much for hammering some nails with us.
My pleasure.
So what happens when your dream home needs a little sprucing up? Sean Kravitz is a public interest lawyer in Los Angeles. We paid him a visit at his home in East Hollywood.
We are outside right now at my favorite place in the house, my little chicken coop. And this is Betsy Beulah Schnitzel and Nugget. Right now it's spring, so everything's overgrown in the best way possible. We also have about 100 sunflowers that are 12 feet tall. It's a pretty magical place back here. The backyard did not look like this when I moved in. It was mostly concrete and dead grass, but everything is pretty brand new. I bought this house in March of 2013. I purchased this house for $395,000, and since purchasing it, I have probably spent around $15,000 to $20,000 in repairs and renovation. when I moved in, there were disgusting old carpets on all of the floors and dark wood paneling. It was a place that I could live in, but not a place that I'd want to bring anybody to. I started by ripping off the paneling and the walls and then replastering and painting over everything. And I started pulling up the carpets and actually originally found beautiful hardwood floors that were part of the original house. And then I kept pulling the carpet. There were stains and cracks and holes everywhere. So I ended up having to replace all of the floors throughout the house. I went to a store and bought wood and watched some YouTube videos and bought a nail gun. And now, surprisingly, I have floors that I'm pretty happy with. The renovations have continued slowly but surely. I have redone almost every room in the house with the exception of the kitchen so far. One of the biggest recent purchases was an air conditioning unit. I spent quite a bit of money on it, about $14,000. It is already paying off, though, because there have been some nights here in Los Angeles that have been completely miserable. I wanted to make an investment in this home, and I try to continuously make smart investments for purposes of both my own desire to live in an environment that I like and also for resale potential. I grew up with a set of parents that just flipped houses my entire life. I moved from one place to another, sometimes with only 3 or 4 months in between one house and a different one. I really want to stay put for as long as I can. That said, I have this weird desire all the time to find something better that I feel happier in. I don't know how long I'll be here, but it's been a pretty great place so far.
When it comes to fresh starts, there are few feelings of relief like being debt-free, but that's not easy to accomplish. Americans are drowning in student debt. We owe about $1.2 trillion, which is more than our combined credit card bill. In fact, borrowing for school has tripled in the last decade, which has led to all sorts of questions, not least of which, should we forgive that mountain of student debt and give people a financial clean slate? But what would that mean for taxpayers who have loaned the bulk of that money? What does it mean for the economy? Those are some big questions. And to explore possible answers, we're joined by Angela Boatman and Brent Evans. They're assistant professors of public policy and higher education at Peabody College at Vanderbilt University. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hi.
So you've been doing some work lately on how all of this student debt is playing out among different segments of the population. And the phrase that comes up in your work is loan aversion. What does that mean?
So Brent and I have been doing some work recently where we're basically exploring this group of students or this subset of the population that we believe might be loan averse. So on average, we know that the returns to higher education, they do exceed the cost of borrowing. And while that may not be true for every individual student, on average, that is widely true. And so what we're interested in is this idea of loan aversion, where there's basically this subset of people who may not borrow because they are averse to taking on debt. So as a result, they don't enroll in college, or they maybe enroll in a college that isn't the best fit for them, or they enroll part-time as a way of working to pay for this. And we are just interested in learning more about why people choose to make those decisions as opposed to borrowing to finance their education.
And there's some anecdotal evidence that different populations of students are loan averse. For example, Hispanic Latino students are typically discussed as being more loan averse, but there's no quantitative evidence that that's true. And that's one of the goals of our study, to actually ascertain how demographics play a role into debt aversion that may show students are underinvesting in college.
You guys are looking forward here, because when you talk about loan aversion, you're anticipating the response in certain segments of the community, but that doesn't mitigate the problem right now, which is well over $1 trillion worth of student debt that has accumulated and higher education costs that are now so profound that virtually almost everybody needs some sort of financial aid to get into a college. What is out there right now to deal with that aspect of the problem?
One of the programs I think that has been receiving a lot of attention recently is the income-based repayment programs. The income-based repayment programs allow a student to repay basically the amount of their loan that is congruent with the amount of income that they are taking in. And so one of these programs or a program like this would certainly suggest that students would be able to eliminate some of the risk that might come with taking out student loans and as a result be able to have some security or safety knowing that they will be able to pay that back.
Does that restructure the loan exclusively or does it actually forbear on some of the obligation?
It forbears, that's right. So the idea of income-based repayment system is that you would pay, depending on which program that you're under, and right now there are several different programs depending on when you borrowed federal financial loans, but the idea is that you would pay a certain percentage of your discretionary income, and any amount that's above that would still sit in your loan balance. However, at some point, you may be able to pay that in the future if your income rises and you're able to then pay off more of your discretionary income. You could potentially pay off the remainder of that loan. The idea is to ensure that borrowers cannot fall into default. They can actually continue to pay, even though it would be smaller than what they would pay under a standard 10-year repayment system.
And it's worth pointing out that student debt is one of the forms of debt that cannot be wiped out by a bankruptcy filing. So once you've got it, you've got it. Now, there have been some proposals in Congress, none of which that have passed, that have called for actually forgiving all student debt, just a clean slate, a second start. What would that do? Because it seems like that means that taxpayers would eat over $1 trillion in outstanding debt.
That's right. The idea behind limiting the amount of money that can be forgiven on student loans at the end of a repayment period is really to prevent what we're trying to do here is to prevent highly paid professions who may have to take out a lot of student loans in order to afford their graduate or professional degrees, but in the end, they will end up making a great deal of income. These programs are designed to, what we would hope, is to prevent professions like doctors and lawyers from taking out these massive amounts of debt, paying the minimum for the length of the forgiveness period, and then ultimately being forgiven on these loans, which, as you suggest, would definitely drive up the taxpayer costs in somewhat unpredictable ways. I think we don't yet know kind of what the impacts of some of these programs would look like. What we'd actually like to see, I think, are debt forgiveness programs that are targeted and really help the low income or the neediest students. I think that's the benefit of debt forgiveness programs. The risk, as you're alluding to, is that we have some folks that take out a great deal of student debt while in college, go on to make a lot of money, but then let the taxpayers shoulder that when they reach the end of their forgiveness period.
To be clear, this sort of mammoth debt forgiveness, right, that you just proposed that people on Capitol Hill might be speaking about, there are a number of debt forgiveness provisions already in place in the law on a much smaller scale. So, for example, if you borrowed a Perkins loan, which is one form of federal loans, there are opportunities to have that debt forgiven if you're teaching in a high-need area. There are other forms of debt forgiveness under income-based repayment plans now, where if you pay for 20 years and you've still paid that percent of your discretionary income every year, after 20 years, the remaining balance is forgiven. In some cases, if you work in a public service field, then that forgiveness can take place in 10 years. So these forgiveness plans already exist to a certain degree, although certainly not on the grand scale that you proposed.
I know you guys aren't economists, but it would seem that if we did forgive all that debt, that's suddenly a whole lot of financial obligation that goes away, which thus means potentially more disposable cash for the economy. It would seem like this is potentially a huge economic stimulus.
So there has been a lot of talk about how people coming out of college with an enormous amount of debt are delaying things such as buying a home, investing and saving for retirement, investing by having children. So it's absolutely possible that the relief of this quantity of debt would stimulate the economy because people would be basically have this debt burden relieved, and they would then start investing that money that they would have paid off that debt into other things.
And we also know defaulting on student loans is highly problematic for students, right? It comes with a whole bunch of consequences when one defaults on their loans. chief among them is that it leads to less access for credit due to these lower credit scores. So we think that people who are credit constrained and are in danger of defaulting on these loans, this has big implications for stimulating the economy, as you suggest, because it really can limit their future purchasing decisions by defaulting on student loans.
And so the trade-off then becomes, is that potential stimulus worth, right, the potential relief of all of this debt? And what sort of moral hazard does that establish for students borrowing in the future?
And that raises all sorts of questions about how fresh a start would they be getting. Angela Boatman and Brent Evans are assistant professors of public policy and higher education at Peabody College at Vanderbilt University. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Today we're talking about beginnings, new starts. That tune tells us it's wedding season, and that's a pricey time of year. Dressing up, shelling out for a hotel and a gift, hosting a bridal shower, a bachelor party, or, yeah, walking down the aisle. I do also means ka-ching. But you don't want to put off the money talk until after the honeymoon. You want to be open and candid up front about all aspects of your soon-to-be-wedded finances, from the state of your respective credit scores to whether you'll be pooling your cash in a joint account. Rob Luchow and Jesse Rosen have tied the knot. And so is their money.
We got married May 10th of last year, almost a year ago.
We were dating for about 2.5 years before. And
No. We were dating for 3 years before.
And we were engaged for about a year prior to getting married.
We talked about money in terms of being cautious about money, like, could we afford to go on this vacation? What was I making? What was he making? Because things were separate at that point. And I probably was more concerned about contributing equally.
We also, I think, come from a bit of a different philosophical place when it comes to money. And that, I think you tend to be on the more frugal side of things. And I don't want to say that I'm a splurger, but I definitely came from the world where, like, if you want it, you can have it. And obviously, we weren't buying ridiculous things. But if you need a nice dinner, like, it's okay to go do that. So I think in our relationship, we also had that dichotomy.
That's fair. I would say that I am money nervous and you're money comfortable.
Oh, that's
even
nice.
Though we both have a fair understanding of kind of what we have and what we want in the future.
As we were dating, and I think when you were engaged, you decided to leave your full-time job and pursue writing, which obviously I'm tremendously supportive of. And I think we had to have a realistic conversation about me taking on a little bit more of the financial burden in that sense. You know, obviously I was comfortable with it because I believe in you and your career and figured this will all even out someday, maybe not right now, but that's the hope.
That was when I started to get really concerned about having someone be an impartial guide. I like to think that we're smart people, but like not a business class between us.
No,
just I didn't
openly
know.
Got a C in macroeconomics.
And I didn't take it.
As we started to get together, I think we did want to really take that to the next level and have a better understanding of, even when you're engaged, knowing what best to do with your money.
I didn't want to fight about it. We started talking about seeking the help of a financial advisor and ultimately went that way a little bit before getting married. Part of that for me was about having another person that we could talk to about this that would help us not play a blame game about money or weigh those big decisions so that they were more financial and less emotional and just kind of be professional about it so that it was something that we could kind of a little bit separate from our marriage, knowing that there's no way that it doesn't become a factor.
The truth is, I think that our money is all one big pot of money. And so even though I have a credit card that is only under my name and we have a joint credit card and then you have your own credit card, it's all coming from the same pot. The split isn't a traditional split that way, but there's definitely times where I oddly want to pay things using my own credit card, even though I technically know it's all the same money, but there's something that's still kind of a nice emotional thing, feeling like I paid for this when it comes to a gift.
And also the way that it works for us is that we can determine how much money to keep in our separate accounts versus to put into savings. So I made the decision that I wanted less money in my account so that more money could go into savings. And I kind of feel good about that. Like I'm putting more in. You did the same. When I take something out of the personal account, I really think about it. Like I've reserved this much money. So do I need this facial? Yes. It may sound to people who are thinking about getting married that having an advisor is something that is only necessary if you have a lot of money. But I actually feel like the opposite, that because we're starting out, it's even more valuable. I would feel different.
Funny. When you're getting married, people usually, if you're religious, you often sit down with a priest or a rabbi, or people will encourage you to take like a few therapy sessions. But like, I say go meet with a financial advisor, because that is so critical in a relationship that, you know, the whole point of this is figuring out how to work as a couple with your money. And thankfully, we have always been really strong emotionally together. And in this case, not that we weren't strong financially, but it was probably the one thing that we would have wanted to be more secure going into marriage, and to have this person help us, I think has made it, you know, has made us even stronger.
I would say we were not strong financially and now we are.
That was more definitive than I put it.
To learn more about how a couple should approach the money side of marriage, I spoke with Louis Barajas, a certified financial planner. Hiya, Louis. Now, one thing I don't get here is if we're talking about moolah, doesn't that take all the romance out of the equation?
The romance is taken away a little bit, but you know what? Transparency, honesty, integrity with your money creates a trusting relationship, and all relationships are based on trust. And I think the number one stress in marriage are finances, is debt. And if we can kind of, you know, solve those issues at the beginning, you're really starting a really strong marriage.
All right, so let's talk about the actual things you need to do. Obviously, your first step is openness. You need to be clear and transparent with your partner.
People are getting married a little bit older now. They've accumulated a certain number of assets, and that's where the transparency comes in. Like, do you want to have a prenuptial agreement done? And that'll take the romance out real quickly. But it's really important that people do that because, again, I as a financial planner have to deal with probability, not possibility. And the probability is that, you know, over 50% of most people that get married end up in divorce. And what's the first thing that you have to do when somebody files a divorce is file a financial statement. So you need to protect yourself.
All right, let's say she has a really good financial profile and he's coming in with a lot of debt. How do you deal with a situation like that?
Well, it's not that it's a good or a bad situation. As long as the couple knows about the financial situation that they're in, the debt or, you know, the school loans that they're coming in together, and they have a plan to work those out, that's okay. There's not a problem with that, as long as they understand how they're going to work those through. Because life will change on people, and so you just have to be very fluid with what's going on. So, you know, financial lives change a lot. People get sick, people get divorced, people want to stay home and take care of their kids.
Now, what if the two people don't have matching credit scores? Let's say he has a terrific credit score, but she is kind of lagging. Do you co-sign for loans at this point? Do you try and bring the other one up, or do you try and keep it separate so that the one with the higher credit score isn't dragged down?
Well, that depends. I'll share with you a great story. I got married. I had a wonderful credit score. My wife didn't have a credit score. We bought a house. We bought it in my name only. So over a few years, we really worked on her credit and developing her credit score. As soon as she got it up, we refinanced the house, put her name on the house. And, you know, David, right now, she's got a better credit score than I do. And I've got a wonderful credit score. So it just depends on what you're trying to buy, whether you're buying a car, whether you're buying a house, or you're just going to get her or him a credit card to build their credit. Again, every situation will depend upon what you're trying to accomplish.
And over the lifespan of a relationship, the two credit scores even out.
Absolutely.
When my wife and I got married, we made a deliberate decision to pool all our money into single accounts. We thought that was an expression of the trust we were placing in one another and the commitment.
And how did it work for you?
Well, it worked out well. Thank goodness we've been together for a long time now. And yet, is that the smart play? Is it wiser for two people to maybe pool their money in a joint account, but at the same time keep little life rafts floating aside in separate accounts?
I'm the same way. When I got married, I did it the exact same way that my parents did. They had one joint account. We just pool all our money, pay all the bills through there, automate our savings, automate, you know, our retirement plan, and whatever we have left can spend it on our vacations. Some people come in and they're older and they're very independent. And sometimes what you do is you can do a joint account and each other can keep their own separate accounts. Pool the money that you're going to need for the house, the utility bills, but maybe keep a little separate on the side. That may work. Whatever's best for the couple, again, that's the most important thing, is to have those kind of conversations before you get married, not afterwards.
There have been some articles lately about so-called financial infidelity, where people are not disclosing financial issues to their partner, which leads to trouble down the road. It seems as though no matter how you approach a marriage or any relationship for that matter, trust is the bedrock. And when you stir finances into the mix, if you're not trusting one another, you're virtually setting yourself up for problems down the road.
That's it. As soon as somebody in that relationship find out that there's something going on that wasn't disclosed, then you get other problems. And those will go beyond just financial issues. Those will go, whether it's emotional, physical, spiritual issues will pop up. But what's important to deal with here also are things that other people don't think about when they're getting married. I just met with somebody who's getting married a couple of days ago, and we were doing a tax rejection because all of a sudden we had two people that were filing as single, are now going to have to file married in 2015. They're combining incomes. We're looking at beneficiary designations. We had these single people who had group, term life insurance policies, and they had each other had named their mothers as beneficiaries. And now we've got to name each other as beneficiaries. Or all of a sudden, we're planning these estate plans, where they have these durable powers of attorney, advanced healthcare directives, where they're naming each other, but before they had their parents. So there's so many different issues when it comes to getting married that you've got to really start sitting down and ideally meet with either a financial planner or make a list of all the items that you got to start thinking about.
So I should fess up to my wife about that big pile of Bitcoins that I've got online.
Nice. Okay, you should fess up to your wife. Absolutely.
Luis Barajas is a certified financial planner. Luis, thanks as always.
David, thank you.
Money can't buy you love, but it can score you a new nose. As the economy improves, more and more Americans are seeking a new beginning with plastic surgery. According to the American Society of Plastic Surgeons, nearly 16 million people went under the knife last year. That's up 3% from a year before. So to check out this trend firsthand, I paid a visit to Dr. Lloyd Krieger. He's a plastic surgeon on Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills. That's pretty woman territory. I wanted to ask about the big picture, as well as to see what could be done to improve my own richer gearness. We chatted as I sat for a consultation in Dr. Krieger's examination room.
I see some lines on your forehead. I see horizontal lines that go all the way across. And then I see a couple of vertical lines between your eyebrows. And those vertical lines in particular can make you look a little bit frowny.
I'm feeling a little frowny.
That's right. So we can soften those up very easily with Botox.
What's the most common procedure that you do?
Probably mostly body surgery.
What percentage of your clientele are female versus male?
I think nationally most plastic surgeons are doing maybe about 8% males. I do closer to about 20%. That's sort of a subspecialty I've developed.
What are the guys coming here for?
Probably men in the younger age groups between 20 and 35. We do a lot of noses.
So if I wanted Rob Lowe's nose, you're the guy to give it to me.
That's correct. Do not go for trying to put somebody else's nose on a different face because it doesn't come out, it doesn't look right, and it tends to be a unfavorable goal for both the surgeon and the patient.
Okay. No Rob Lowe's nose. Good safety tip.
Right.
I got that. I assume your insurer isn't going to cover this. How much does it cost and how do people pay for it?
Insurance will not cover the purely cosmetic procedures, which are elective for subjective appearance improvement. And the prices, like anything, range, maybe even more so in plastic surgery than in other specialties because it's still a bit mom and pop. The cost for liposuction, which I would say with the total combined fee with an anesthesiologist, a surgery center, operating room, and the surgeon, liposuction could range anywhere from about $6,500 to even $15,000. Breast augmentation is anywhere between about $6,000 and $10,000, all packaged in.
And I assume I don't have to pay it all up front. You no doubt have some sort of payment plan.
Well, we do. We have different payment plans, but they are done through third-party financing companies. We have outside banks that provide that service. If people choose to finance, which is paying over installments, they would use that system. Otherwise, people would pay like they would pay for anything, cash, check, or credit card.
Now, what if I came to you and said, well, I want to have a better-looking physique. I want my chest to be more developed. I want stronger-looking biceps. Would you work on me, or would you say, get thee to a gym, young man?
Well, there are certain things that I can treat and make better, and certain things that I cannot. I cannot make biceps bigger.
Yes, you can.
Not well enough for me to want to do it or to provide it to people routinely.
In your experience, are your patients coming in because they're responding to either their own personal insecurities or their own personal issues, or they're responding to external cues, such as they're always watching Keeping Up with the Kardashians, and they're thinking, I don't look like that, and so I need to be more body conscious. Where does it come from?
I think I'm in Los Angeles. I'm in Beverly Hills. That's a very advanced and sophisticated plastic surgery market. People are aware of plastic surgery here in the general community. They have friends who have had procedures done. So people who come to me generally come for a specific reason that they feel. They come because they say, my nose has a bump.
Now, you're not going to give me Rob Lowe's nose, but I've always had a little bit of baby fat right here under my chin, and I would hate for that to turn into a double chin right as I get older. So if I come to you and say, Dr. Krieger, look, would you tell me to diet? Would you tell me to exercise? Or would you tell me what?
Even losing more weight might not necessarily change the appearance of your chin and neck. You do have probably a genetic predisposition to having a little fat deposit under your chin.
Thanks, Dad.
Exactly. What we would do for that is liposuction of the chin. I make a little incision in a crease that everyone has under their chin. So when it heals up, you don't see the scar at all. Then I put in a very small suctioning tube and just vacuum out a little bit of fat in a nice, even way. Put one stitch in that little incision, give you a wrap that kind of holds you tight for a few days, and you'll see a nice difference.
Price tag?
Price tag total would be about $4,000 to $5,000.
That's some serious scratch.
Well, beauty isn't always cheap, I guess.
After I and my turkey neck left Dr. Krieger's office, I decided to look into some average starting prices for the most common plastic surgery procedures. If you're thinking about getting a little work done, you may want to start saving. A breast augmentation will cost you almost $3,700, and that's the national average, not the Beverly Hills price. A larger butt, that'll run you more than $4,000. Fuller lips, $2,000. And here's a fun fact. Americans, both men and women, spend more than $1 billion a year on nose jobs. And that's our show. Lizzie will be back in the saddle soon. I'll be back next week as we talk about the various economic aspects of speed. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Jenny Ament and Eliza Mills, with help this week from Tobin Lowe, Tony Wagner, and Aparna Alluri. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Bill Lance is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. As always, make sure to check with your financial advisor before making any investment decisions. I'm David Lazarus of the LA Times. Until next time, I'll see you in the business section. This is APM.